do was to pose the two questions that I posed when we talked last night at Columbia about mass incarceration. One question is, what kind of people do we want to be? The other is, what kind of world do we want to live in? And the intersection between the two of them. You know, because Cornell and I are working on this, both in terms of the October month of resistance to mass incarceration, going on this month. Get with it, go online and check it out, get ready for October 22nd, but also the November 15th dialogue that Cornel West is going to be doing with Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party. So those two questions and the intersection, if you think there is an intersection, we can...
There is an intersection,
later.
But I mean, we'd have a whole new talk scheduled to be able to answer those questions. I mean, obviously, from since I'm the High Priestess of Love, I think that part of how we approach a lot of this is through love. I mean, one of the things, I have to go back to the James Brown movie, one of the things that I found so disturbing was that they allowed the little light-skinned brown boy to play James Brown, when we know so much of the trauma of James Brown's life was that he was perceived to be black and ugly. And he was tortured, psychologically tortured and abandoned. So that when we see him growing up to be misogynist, cruel, there's a backstory. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the film, catering as it did to the white viewer, did not try to give us that backstory. I even had a white person say to me, well, we couldn't have had an unattractive black boy playing James Brown because we wouldn't have identified with his pain. And I'm always telling people, within the context of white supremacy, dark-skinned black people suffer the most. In the dailiness of life, there are special hatreds reserved. So that was too long, Bell Hooks. What's your question? Stand up, tell people.
I can't hear you on the live stream. That's why I'm making you guys.
Oh, okay.
The dangerous live stream.
I'm Joseph Matthews, a friend of Bell and Cornell, and also a dean of students at a Brooklyn school. I'm having an issue with, at my school, currently we've had 40 suspensions in this month since school has started. 39 of them have been males, one female. And so I'm struggling with this question of, are we creating young men who will grow up to hate women and be their abusers? And it's 99%.
Well, the answer is yes.
Right. But how do we address that when 99% of my staff are white female women?
No, it sounds like the white sisters got a lot of work to do. When you take on the awesome task of being a teacher and every child is precious and priceless, and then you move and deal with black and brown, and probably not too many red, that is in Brooklyn, the black and brown children, as a white teacher, it means that you're going to have enough courage and empathy to get inside of their world and have a sense of what they're up against so that your teaching can be not just on the surface, but
skin
deep.
Well, we know that
deep.
So many grown white people are afraid of black children. So the same kind of fears that they may have of an adult black man, they may have of a black male child.
So we have to really talk
about what are white people doing to decolonize their minds?
That's the work that needs to be done. That's exactly right. But we also, I know we got some other questions, but we also have the class question, though. You got some black upper middle class folk who really don't believe that precious Letitia or precious Jamal is part and parcel of their collective fate.
All right.
You see, and this is a class cleavage that has to do, and it's also generational, where the fears and all the stereotypes, again, in TV, film, video, and so forth. And this is why I think love, at its deepest level, is the only thing that can rupture that. And by love, we're talking about love of truth, love of knowledge, love of learning, love of justice, because love is a form of death. You see, a market culture is a death-denying culture. But love is a form of death. You'll never be able to get on the edge of that abyss to make the leap to know what love is unless you're willing to take that risk, be it personally, in which your isolated, lonely self is killed in order for a new self to emerge and tangle with a new self. with another self, with a smile, at least for a while? Or love of wisdom, where you undergo fundamental transformation. Your prejudices and presuppositions are called into question. That's the form of death, to be reborn, to become more mature in your critical orientation.
So are you able to do any kind of decolonization like that with these white women?
That's a good question.
I have been working on it, but you have a lot of people who think that just because they mean well, that they're right.
Yeah, otherwise known in some circles, white privilege.
Yes, right.
And luckily, I would say in part due to radical feminist movement, we have a greater understanding of the mechanisms of white privilege. And that will help us in this public education where more and more the teachers of black children and brown children are white skinned. We wish we could be here forever, but alas, it's all his fault.
What time is it? No, we got time. Wait, is this clock right, though, sister?
I bought this little watch at the Salvation Army.
At 5:40.
Yes. What do you think, Maria? You're in charge, not him.
We got time. We got time.
How much time?
Maria said we got time.
What?
20 minutes.
Okay.
Oh, is that all right, 20 minutes?
Yes.
All
right. Ron, are you trying to say something?
Just a quick question. Can you say something, given that you're talking about education right now, about the possibility of sustaining education as a practice of freedom?
Why everybody has to have these deep and, you know.
This is new school.
I'm going to tell you truthfully, because I live in a small town in America in Appalachia. I am a big proponent of homeschooling and homeschooling for boys, because I believe that the public school is such a violent context. It's, you know, let's not forget Foucault's lessons about the development of the prison system. The public school architecturally designed on the basis of the prison system. And so why are we surprised then that black boys within, and all boys within such a system, then behave like criminals? So I want everybody to ponder that, because I get so tired of people telling me that we need military schools for black boys. And I say, why is it no one ever says we need Montessori schools or we need homeschooling for black boys?
Absolutely.
Because that is the context where the genuine value of self can be nurtured. It will not be nurtured in the public school. The public school, I'm going to be cynical here, is going to become more and more a prison, a concentration camp for the young, so that we're not going to see what we have in the public school is that wonderful paragraph I talk about in Teaching to Transgress, that as teachers, we can know ecstasy in the classroom. So I want to give the props to every teacher in the public school that dares to defy and resist and bring the humanization into the classroom. And we know that those teachers are there. And we also know that they are frequently at risk. If you come to the 7 o'clock, we have this wonderful teacher, black male teacher of eighth graders, who teaches anti-racism, anti-sexism, and he's going to talk about his students and what it's like to educate them for critical consciousness. Another question?
Paideia School.
Your name, sweetie? Yes, you.
Hello.
We want to get you on the live stream.
Thanks very much. My name is Kelly Thomas out of Newark, New Jersey. And also representing Sadie Nash Women's Leadership Project here. I wanted to know, what do you all pray for? Being a spiritual warrior, prayer warrior myself, and hearing you all start with that basis of spiritual grounding and that foundation of love. When you talk about, you know, there was a little Jamal on the PATH train the other day that got up in my face because I asked him to be quiet on the train. He came on the train at 2 a.m., very rowdy. And I was like, hey, come on. You know, there was grown men all over the train. And Jamal got in my face talking about if he had it on him, he was going to let it fly off. I don't even know him like that. You know what I mean? And no one said anything, you know? my friend here, you know, eventually stepped in and was like, okay, well, you know, well, maybe what exactly are you so angry about? And I told him I loved him, but he's going off, you know. There were grown men, young men, all sort of men and women. There were eventually some white women in the corner that ratched up and started, like, cursing at him and stuff. I'm telling him I love him. She's trying to dialogue with him, you know. And he was like, well, if she had called me sir, but you came on the train like, da, da, da. You know what I mean? So what, you know, what... When I get quiet and when I really think about as an educator, as a lover, as a citizen, you know, what I need to be affirming for the young men, the women of all, you know, peoples in my life. Like, what do y'all pray for thinking about little Jamal and little Letitia? What exactly does that young man need to calm down all that rah-rah?
And how old was this precious brother? How old was he?
I would say he was about
17, 18
or so.
Oh, so he's not a little brother.
He's
big and tall.
But he wasn't like her. But there was a strange.
No, but for you to express that kind of love, I thought he was 7 or 6. He's 17. I mean, my response is this. See, my prayer every night is to be a blessing. You see? And so much of the world is wrestling with frustrated, neglected love. So every attempt of expression of love, even if it doesn't work, it's still worth it. My dialogues I have with the brothers in the prison, oftentimes when they reflect back on their lives, the things they remember were the moments when the love tried to flow and they cut it off. See what I mean? So they remember that moment. Now, I was blessed to write a song with a genius named Bootsy Collins on the Funk Capital of the World. And the name of the song is When Love is a Threat. Because if you've been in the world for so long and everybody's looking at you coming in negative ways, you're not used to love, then when somebody, even for that one moment, that love, that's a threat to him.
Nikki Giovanni says, I ain't
shit. Bootsy do the singing.
Lower than that to camp.
I'm not a singer. I do spoken word. But
I was just saying.
We about to get into it, I think. But the,
I was saying, Nikki Giovanni always got it in her woman poem where she said, I ain't shit. You must be lower than that to care. So that,
yeah,
that she gets that multiple layers of internalized oppression.
Absolutely.
But I want to say every day when I pray, I make my list of the individuals that I want to enter. I believe in intercessory prayer, that my prayer for others has power in healing their lives. And I pray for my own healing. I have my 4 points that I have to pray regularly for. Divine will, that I know divine will for my life. Cornell and I talked earlier about the sense of divine calling, what motivates you in your life.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to give words to the expression of, if I think I'm going in a direction and divine spirit says, no, bell hooks, that's not the direction I intend you to go in, that requires the kind of courage. My pastor said to me, your heart has to be ready to handle the weight of your calling. Because as I was telling Cornell earlier that I had written in my journal, my fear is fighting against my faith. And that for me is where prayer becomes the restorative. And I am very much into the power of gratitude. My sisters, we've had a lot of loss in the family. We do get together every night, my sister that lives where I live, to give thanks and to find both big and small those things to give thanks in our lives for. Because a lot of times we forget the abundance here in this first world, imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy that many of us live in, even if we're poor. Mm-hmm. That when we compare the rest of the world, you know, when we're turning on water, I am pretty obsessed with water. And when people try to talk to me about gas and oil, I say, you know, we can live without gas and oil, but we can't live without water. And there are already places in the United States where women on welfare are having to pay for water. And be mindful, who's going to get hot water in the future? Brother, your question?
As a post-diasporic reconditioned people in the imperialist world of today.
Take the mic. Wow, let's see if he can remember how to say all that again.
Okay.
Start with your name, brother.
I'm Jordan Anderson. As a post-diasporic reconditioned on people in the imperialist world of today, instant gratification, largely consciously disconnected,
Where do we see ourselves going as a people, especially, us black males, we're at risk. You know, how do you see us moving collectively when we're separated?
A lot of black men feel they're moving towards death. They're embracing death. I see it in the loneliness of aging black men, over 60-some black men who have often severed all the bonds and the connections in their life. I don't care for his book, but the book Going Solo really is examining how many people in our nation are living alone, and especially men, and how many men are going into these kind of groups. They're not group homes, but they're like where you just have your room, and you may have a communal bathroom. And there are a lot of black men, especially black men. I mean, one of the things, these are things Michelle Alexander talked about. What happens to black men who are coming out of prison, who are poor, jobless, et cetera. And a lot of those men are going into these kind of homes, and there's no connection to be in these homes. It's a lonely, lonely life. And for a lot of black men, there's a feeling that death has to be better than this lonely life.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's what we saw in Ferguson.
All right,
all right. You reached a point where the different gangs that have been going against each other came together. We hadn't seen it at that scale since Rodney King, Los Angeles, 1992. And when they looked in the eyes of not the police, but the National Guard with the tanks and ready for Baghdad-like activity and said, "We ready to die."
Yes, that was scary.
Which side do you think was more fearful? The military was more fearful. Because if that's true in the South Side of Chicago, that's true in Harlem, that's true in Chocolate Slices of Brooklyn, that's true in Black Newark across the board, there'll never be enough police. Never, ever. So then this is where the prophetic comes in. How do you channel that rage into love and justice rather than hatred and revenge? Because the rage sooner or later is going to bubble up.
That's right.
You reap what you sow.
It's
sooner or later, you
have
to come
up
to terms with it. And at that point, then they're going to be busting us in. Wasn't y'all talking about love? Y'all were the two black folks talking about love. They all want to kill us. Let's talk about love now. Let's talk about love now. I say, well, no, we didn't do it just for some utilitarian. We did it because it's right, because it's moral, because
we'll
it's just.
We'll get you the mic. He'll ask his question. Your name?
I'm Michael Cornell. It's nice to see you again. James Logan introduced us 2 years ago at Earlham when he came to talk about Manning Marable.
Yes.
I asked you to give Bill Maher some Edward Said. I think you still should. My question is, to what extent do you think the comparison between the plight of our friends in Gaza and our friends in Ferguson is useful or not?
Oh, no, I think it's a very important juxtaposition that Gaza is a ghetto. Gaza is a concentration camp. Gaza is under vicious Israeli occupation. They've been there a long time, and they're trying to come up with ways of sustaining themselves with no control over their borders, their land, their sea, their air force, the sea and food going in and out. Now, it has a different history in that sense. We have to tell a story about how did a persecuted, hated, despised people for 2,000 years in the face of vicious attack, namely precious Jewish brothers and sisters, jumping out of the buildings in Europe all trying to kill them, thugs like Hitler, landing on somebody else's land and having to raise a question. Black people had the same question in Liberia. You're going to coexist? You're going to dominate. Einstein said coexist. Ahakaham said coexist. Jabotinsky said dominate. Netanyahu comes out of Jabotinsky. Begin, Jabotinsky. Jewish terrorist group, Ergon, and so forth, you see. So that domination and that dominating orientation more and more becomes widespread in this new state, given its attacks. Now, I mean, Hamas and the others was trying to kill innocent Jewish brothers and sisters, Israeli brothers and sisters, no doubt about that. There's no doubt about that, you know? Well, I mean, did they succeed to a certain degree with suicide and so forth, but not at the level. We're talking about 500 precious Palestinian babies facilitated by U.S. support and facilitated by American U.S. imperial policy. So that, but then we had to tell a story about how did the black ghettos get to be? Well, it's a different kind of story, but you can see some of the elective affinities and similarities. There's some dissimilarities, too. But the juxtaposition is real, and the folk who are involved in the struggle make it clear. They call the folk in Ferguson. This is what you do when the tear gas come your way. We're veterans at this. You're neophytes at the moment. You see what I mean?
We have a question right here. This sister up here. pass that mic on. Were you trying to ask a question? Go ahead. You can, you know, you can ask it, and she'll wait for you.
Hi, I'm Quanda Johnson, and I wanted to ask you to speak a little bit more. You you mentioned about James Brown and the little boy that played him, and the fact that being the darkest among black people is they have the hardest time, and it's the worst. I want to kind of throw a wrench into that system. Being a very light-skinned black woman who has very Afrocentric features, I grew up in a situation where I was harassed and tortured by everybody, white, black, dark-skinned black, because it was almost criminal to be as fair as I was, and I was a light, I was a lot fairer then, with the map of Africa stamped on my face and hair. So I'd love for you to talk more about that conundrum within the African culture, African-American culture, or black American culture.
Well, I think that, one, we have got to talk more, my people, about trauma and the multiple faces of trauma. Because, yes, light-skinned black people have often experienced grave trauma, a lot of it in the color caste system at the hands of other black people. But I am saying that there is a particular trauma that visits itself upon dark-skinned black people that I think those of us who are lighter can't even name.
Right.
You know, my sisters that are dark, what you face when you go out of your house every day. They don't get asked. I get asked, oh, what country are you from? You know, they don't get asked, what country are you from? You know, I mean, it's a total different experience. And as black people, I think, going back to issues of whether we're traitors or what, we have been unable to talk about the ways in which the color caste system divides us. And what I will say about the lighter you are, the greater you have a chance for change. Whereas if you are that little dark-skinned black kid that's been treated like a monster from day one, because, you know, if you're a lighter-skinned black person, somebody may love you along the way. Somebody may want to take you home along the way, but we may not find that among darker-skinned black people in our society. Okay, we're ready for you, my sister, my pretty, beautiful, dark-skinned black sister.
Thank you.
Your name?
My name is Marlena Franklin, and one of the questions I have is when there are tragedies of death in predominantly white communities or all white communities, one of the things I notice and I admire is there's a group of psychologists or therapists to take care of the children and parents involved in the aftermath. Our children are deeply in pain, I feel. And we don't seem, this is where the churches come in, we don't seem to be able to give them that support because they're going through trauma every day.
Well, I think this is the negative side of Christianity, that the critical, the way we have to critique Christianity, because so often Christianity has tried, people in the name of Christianity have tried to say, don't try to heal. Don't see a therapist. I remember when my brother was dealing with his drug addiction, it was like, just pray about it. If you took it to Jesus, you would be okay. And there's a lot to be said for taking it to Jesus and your therapist. You know?
Sometimes you take your therapist to Jesus, too.
Another question? Back in the back, you're wearing a hat.
What you're saying and understand and see what that means for me and for my black community. So I guess my question is what is it that you're seeking in giving to the non-black and brown members of the audience?
Well, we are constantly seeking to educate as the practice of freedom. And I can tell you, every non-black person in this room has to have that same decolonizing education to resist imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy. So to me, it's like we come to the water. We may drink for different reasons, but the point is to quench our thirst. And so that I think that everyone in this room has the opportunity to take something away from this room that will quench some thirst within you. As we begin to close, one of the things I want to say, part of what's the fun of talking with Cornell is that we both do believe in fun. That's why we danced our way to tenure at Yale and through a lot of the pain and the suffering and went to church, black church at Yale, the sense of what it means. I mean, Paolo was very clear that we should have delight, that there should be joy in struggle.
That's right.
So we leave you with that, to take joy in struggle. If you're struggling in some way where you can't find any joy, it's time to step back, reevaluate, and consider, is there a struggle that can restore to me that sense of joy?
All I can say is that's the last word, because that's right on the, just the nail on the head. Thank you so much, Bell Hooks. Bell Hooks in the house. Bell Hooks in the house. I love you. That was a rich song. This is not the last time. Did you hear that?
No. That was so good.
This is WRCT Pittsburgh, and we've been listening to a conversation that was originally recorded back in October of 2014 at the New School there in New York City. And it was a conversation between Bell Hooks and Cornell West. So we hope you sat back, took all of that in, and listen very closely, because a lot of things that they were talking about are things that we are seeing lately and things that we have been dealing with for a number of years now. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. This is Kevin Amos. This is One-to-One Jazz Corner on a Sunday. And, you know, we do different things from time to time. So I thought it was a good time to get this in. Now we have more music and some other segments coming up on the program for Sunday. So stay with us. You never know what you might hear.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section. When Dad injured his back. When your basketball star tore his ACL. Opioids helped with the pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Opioids are powerful pain-reducing prescription medicines, but most people who are prescribed opioids don't finish their prescriptions. So millions of unused opioids are sitting in homes across the country. And tragically, more than 100 Americans die every day from overdoses involving opioids. What can you do to protect your family? Remove the risk of unused opioids from your home. Pills, patches, or syrups in drawers, purses, and cabinets. Anywhere they might be hiding. To find out how to dispose of them properly, visit www.fda.gov/drug disposal.
Email from school about the incident today.
Scary.
You know, teachers like me, parents, we don't always know as much as you guys do about what's going on with other kids.
Half the time, it's rumors.
Yeah, but if you're ever concerned about a friend who's having trouble with alcohol, prescription drugs, anything, you need to tell an adult, someone you know and trust. That can be hard, but speaking up about a problem is what helping a friend is all about.
For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
I need to pay bills. When is my tax refund coming?
I need to pay my taxes. What are my payment options?
I need to set up a payment plan. How do I do that?
I need answers to my tax questions. Where can I find them?
I need help with my taxes. Does the IRS offer free help?
I need a tax preparer. How should I choose one?
Need answers to your tax questions? Go to irs.gov.
As a public service to the listeners of WRCT, we have compiled a short list of items you should not have in your possession at the present time. 1. A muscle car. 2. A Betamax. 3. Acid-washed anything. 4. A members-only jacket. 5. Stirrup pants. 6. Asbestos. 7. Hummelware. 8. Sweet and Low. 9. Copies of Dynetics or Megatrends. And 10. A radio not tuned to 88.3 FM. If you do have any of these items, WRCT suggests you get with the program.
So imagine this. You have a routine medical procedure, let's say a colonoscopy. You're insured and your doctor is in network. But then you get an unexpected bill. That's exactly what happened to a woman who got a COVID test in an emergency room and then ended up with a $6,000 bill because the test went to an outside lab not covered by her insurance. The Journal of the American Medical Association found that 1 in 5 patients were hit with an out-of-network charge after having surgery. These bills can set you back hundreds, even thousands of dollars. 50% of Americans are actually carrying some medical debt right now, which, of course, can make paying those bills and managing the regular expenses seem almost impossible. Well, relief arrived on January 1st in the form of a new law. The No Surprises Act bans many of these surprise bills. Katie Keith is a researcher at the Center on Health Insurance Reforms at Georgetown University. Katie Keith, so nice to have you. Thank you for talking with me. So we know that the No Surprises Act went into effect on January 1st. Walk us through the basic features of this legislation and what exactly it does.
What the No Surprises Act means is that those with private health insurance shouldn't face what we call surprise out-of-network bills anymore. And what I mean when I say surprise out-of-network bills, this is really for patients who do everything right. If you schedule some kind of service, you make sure that the folks who are going to see you are in network. I would expect that my anesthesiologist would be in network. I didn't choose that doctor. You know, maybe you're in an emergency. You can't pick the hospital you're going to or the physician you're going to see. You're taken simply to the nearest emergency room, and then you have a surprise bill that lands, you know, in your mail. And these bills can range anywhere from hundreds of dollars to, you know, 5 figures.
So we gave an example in your introduction about a woman who got a COVID test, went to the ER, didn't realize that it was sent to a lab out of network, had this multi-$1,000 fee. How common is that?
In general, there's estimates that 1 in 5 hospital visits results in one of these out-of-network bills.
So will this legislation then just end that? No more surprise bills?
The only exception where you might see one of these bills is if you're taken by a ground ambulance. It tends to be a little bit more complicated. Some of them are owned by cities and counties. There were several reasons why Congress didn't take that on, but we are starting to see some action at the state level.
So if you look at how healthcare costs have been rising, now I think it's like 37 states, people there are paying 10% of their median income is going to healthcare costs. And it seems to me to be both crazy and unsustainable.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I would emphasize, I think that 10% figure that you're giving, I think that's for premiums and deductibles. So for folks who were receiving these surprise bills, they were paying even more than that for, again, costs that they didn't even anticipate.
So then what's the best strategy to lower healthcare costs?
In the United States, we just pay so much more for healthcare than many other countries. It's sort of the price is stupid. And so, you know, we're paying so much more. It's about 20% of our GDP, which means, you know, a fifth of our economy is driven by healthcare. I think over time, it's going to be looking at those prices that people are actually being charged. It's going to be probably a focus on value-based care, making sure we're actually getting those outcomes for the amount that we're investing. But it's going to take a lot of work.
Is there anything that you see on the horizon where you could at least have some consistency in costs, right? That even in, you know, neighborhoods, communities close to each other, a procedure, the cost of a procedure can vary wildly.
Yeah, absolutely. Or even if it's not consistent costs, we should know what it is up front so you can be, you know, an informed decision maker and then go to the place you want to go to. And so one initiative that is sort of slowly rolling out is a new transparency initiative. So this is a requirement that hospitals in particular and insurance companies have to sort of tell and show the prices that they charge for different things, including their negotiated rates. The question I think is, will people use that information? Some types of healthcare is sort of shoppable like that. You can look it up before you go. Not all healthcare is. And so we'll at least have a little bit more insight into exactly what those prices are. So it's less of a black box for everybody.
Katie Keith from the Center on Health Insurance Reforms. Thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
This is Kevin Amos. You're listening to One to One, great Black music from the ancient to the future.
The choice you make, decide your fate. Mother heard you singing a sorrow song, falling on a deaf ear. My biggest fear, that the ocean will one day be no more human. Activity causing loss of biodiversity. The time is now. The time has come to save our seas, the river and the trees, the ocean breeze. Conscious of the consumer disease. Oh yeah, rising in the sea, destroying the forest. We have forgotten that we need them both to breathe. The oceans are the lungs of the earth, choking on fragments, fragments of plastic, outnumbering plankton. The time is now. The time has come.
Yeah, man, I'ma tell him it's a thing called Kabaka Premier alongside one named Black on my sing. Selassie, I once again, yeah, yeah.
Okay, come on, yeah.
Real Rastafari.
Yeah. Rastafari live. Even when the buckle feels get crowdy, we don't have no fear, no.
We don't fear them.
When the enemies surround me, Jah will be there,
yeah.
When the tackling get rowdy and them play unfair, oh.
So unfair.
Babylon not tight, Jibble around me, Jah will be there. Jah is in my corner.
And touch from the buckle field. Still away my shin guard, oh Jah Jah, I'm a shield. Pray every day so me never get fatigued. Still I play the game, never drop out of the league. The wicked is my rival, the righteous is my team. The trophy is survival, to win it is my dream. Even when Babylon buy out the referee, we face the penalty and still I win the victory.
Jah is in my corner.
Jah in my corner, yeah, 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 yeah.
The most high is my coach.
With them can't tackle, we just shift them up and rock them up just like a glass buckle. But tell the opposition, said Jah had the savior. Could a shoot, could a cross, all of them him savior. Me say you have to brave, ya. We go make it on the side, ya. We not get relegated, we just ascend just like Elijah. We go take them by surprise, ya. I know them still don't believe them, not in a we league. Them figure retreat to all my skill and my feet.
Okay. Even when the buckle feels get crowdy, we don't have no fear, no.
No, 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 no.
When the enemies surround me, Jah will be there, yeah. When the tackling get rowdy and them play unfair, oh.
So unfair.
Babylon not tight, Jibble around me, Jah will be there. Jah is in my corner.
Jah in my corner, yeah, yeah, yeah.
The most high is my coach.
Emperor Selassie is my coach.
And Jah Jah is my keeper.
My
home, all alone.
Be my Lord.
Jah
to the most time, pride is the last year. Rastafari ever living, ever fearful, ever sure. Come back up, Raymond, and black on my once again. Gangzilla.
If we never get a chance to be together, go with Jah, thank you, love you. But I say it is a pity you already have a wife. A man don't have a man in my life. Rude boy, it is a pity. I say it is such a pity you already have a wife. I may have a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 man in my life. Hey. I would like one of these mornings to wake up and find your face on a pillow lying right next to mine. I would cut out the party and the smoking and the rum and boots of extra wine. Well, every time I fantasize, me see your lips, your right, your finger do something, I left the rude girl hypnotized. For you, it's just a thing, another leg of fling. But for me, this is heaven, and it is such a pity you already have a wife. I made another man in my life. Rude boy, it is a pity. I say it is such a pity you already have a wife. I may have a one man in my life, rude boy. Hey. They book you up in a public and can't even touch it, really mess me up. My check for you, so much the respect when my half for your woman and your kids. Rude boy, I'm a Chris, and no mate it is. Who knows, maybe one day the world will be evolved enough. We'll share your win a civilized manner between the two of us. But until then, I would have loved to see you again. Me know we have to play it by the stupid rules I've been. Well, I said if we never get a chance to be together now, go with Jah, thank your love, yeah. You know, I talk a lot about relationships. But I want to big up a woman today where a fair birthday we are celebrating. I don't think nobody do it good like she. She have some kind of strength where I don't have. I don't even have 1% of it. Rita, big up you. Big up you, Rita, yeah? Hey, I say it is such a pity you already have a wife. I met another man in my life. Rude boy, it is a pity. I say it is such a pity you already have a one life. I may have a one man in my life. Rude boy, oh, hey. I said if we never get a chance to be together, go with Jah, thank your love, yeah. Abba Janai, the Lord of Lords, Abba Janai, light of this world,
Ababa Janai, the letter of God, Ababa Janai, the Redeemer, Ababa Janai, the Holy Messiah, Ababa Janai, Wonderful Counselor, Ababa Janai, Rastafari, Ababa Janai. You make the joy bells ring, and you make the children jump. Yes, no one but Selassie. Children jump, yes. No one but Selassie. Cut now. Omnipotent, Jah omnipotent. Omniscient, Jah omniscient. Yeah, baby. Omnipresent, Jah omnipresent. Him and with Jesus Christ in the second advent. So who make the joy bells ring? And who make the children jump? Yes. No one but Selassie. Ring and do make the children jump. Yes, no one but Selassie. Me said the greatest event in our history was the 2nd November 1930. Me mother never born, only my old granny. The leaders of the world, they was fighting for them. Afraid of the king called King Selassie. 72 nations bow to his majesty. Them crown him king of kings and lord of lords. No one man like Selassie never need nobody guard. So who make the joy bells ring? Yeah, do make the children jump. Yes, no one but Selassie. Who make the joy bells ring? Yeah, do make the children jump. Yes, no one but Selassie. Show me say anything me say, you say Ababa Janai. 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 Who is the King of Kings? Ababa Janai. Lord of Lords, Ababa Janai. Light of this world, Ababa Janai. Wonderful Counselor, Ababa Janai. The King and Eagles, Ababa Janai. Who alone can save us? Ababa Janai. Rastafari, Ababa Janai. Selassie, Ababa Janai. Who make the diamonds ring? Yeah, do make the children jump. Yes, no one but Selassie. Diamonds, we did it. Make the children jump. The flowers in the garden.
pine trees. I will point their fingers to the heaven. I'm the bad little songs to sing. That's why I sing, say, love shines brighter than the morning sun. Love shines brighter every day. You've got to believe. Love shines brighter than the morning sun. Love shines brighter every day.
Singing, no worry, yeah.
Email from school about the incident today.
Scary.
You know, teachers like me, parents, we don't always know as much as you guys do about what's going on with other kids.
Half the time, it's rumors.
Yeah, but if you're ever concerned about a friend who's having trouble with alcohol, prescription drugs, anything, you need to tell an adult, someone you know and trust. That can be hard, but speaking up about a problem is what helping a friend is all about.
For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Let's get back into the music. These guys are coming to town for a few nights in November.
Late night radio needs somebody like you. Late night radio needs somebody like you. I think that you could be the midnight DJ and play the records on the air like you say. And technique.
yes, I'm right here. And for only 6 payments of $40.19, you'll be on the air and famous DJ. And if you are one of the first callers, we will send you a signed right here certificate for free. We'll be right back.
for my hunger and another for my greed, and just forget about my